Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Arseblog 20 podcast series, in which we celebrate 20 years of Arseblog by talking to a guest about a calendar year of the site's existence between 2002 and 2022. In this episode, we look back at 2007, and my guest is the man from East Lower.
Hello, how are you?
I'm okay. 2007, what a year. You were still blogging with frequency and regularity?
I was. When we discussed doing this before, and we kind of fell upon 2007. I think I texted you and I said, I have absolutely zero recollection of 2007 at all. But yes, luckily my blog, which even though I had a 1.5 year old at the time, I was still blogging away a lot. So there you go. And so it's been quite helpful. Yeah. 2007. Yeah.
Well, where are we going to start with this? Because, you know, it's an eventful year, as most of the years have been so far and will be as we continue this series from 2002 to 2022. So where do you want to start with this?
I thought I'd start at the League Cup final, which was February 2007, just because it felt like quite an interesting for a couple of reasons, really. And I think the first one is... we lost. We lost to Chelsea, which I know in recent years we've got a pretty good record against them in recent years. But certainly we lost this one. And what was interesting is it was the last ever one at Cardiff. And, you know, I look back with really fond memories of our time in Cardiff. And partly it's because we did lose to Liverpool, obviously, 2-1 in 2001. But we actually had a really good record, won the FA Cup there 2002, 2003, and 2005. Mm-hmm. And I just remember it really fondly as a place to go and watch football. And I don't know whether – I do think it's a much better stadium than Wembley, much more atmospheric. And there's something also about people from London actually having to go somewhere for a cup final rather than being in your own capital, I think. So there was an element of the road trip about it, and I think that added to the excitement. But we had a good time in Cardiff, and this was the last ever one. And, of course, we didn't have a good time. But – but yeah, it was. I've just got fond memories of that stadium. It was also an interesting game because it was one of the youngest teams ever to be in a domestic cup final. And it's quite amazing if you think. Really, it's only what at this point 2.5 years after the Invincibles.
Yeah,
and for Wenger to be putting out, you know, 2 17-year-olds, 2 19-year-olds, it just goes to show how quickly that side, that all-conquering side, was dismantled, really. And the whole Project Youth thing that followed it was really in full swing by this point. And so, you know, we can look back on it now and say it was a project that never got us where we wanted it to go. But it was quite exciting to watch some of these players, you know, sort of Diaby and Walcott and players like that, as they kind of grew. So it was a very, very young side, and Walcott scored his very first goal for Arsenal, age 17.
His very first Arsenal goal. The team that day was Almunia, Justin Hoyt, Armand Traore were the fullbacks, Philippe Senderos, Kolo Touré, Danielson, Diaby, Cesc Fabregas, Jeremy Aliadier, Theo Walcott, and Julio Baptista was the starting 11 that day, with Mark Poom, Johan Juru, Manuel Abue, Alex Klebb, and Adi Bayor on the bench. In comparison, Chelsea side was Cech, Terry, Bridge, Carvalho, Essien, Lampard, Lassana Diarra, who played for us for a hot minute, Claude Makélélé, Michael Ballack, Andrei Shevchenko, and Didier Drogba. And they had Ashley Cole, Salomon Kalou, John Obi Mikel, and Arjen Robben on the bench with a goalkeeper called Hilario, who I'm sure is great fun at parties. but yeah, I seem to remember that team selection by Arsene Wenger was quite deliberate in a way, because he'd played a lot of these kids. Played a lot of these young players in the previous rounds. They'd overcome Liverpool. There was the crazy 6-3 game at Anfield, which I think is the one where Baptista scored four goals. There were two games against Tottenham in the semi-finals. Where Baptista scored a couple in one of those as well. So he kind of wanted to keep faith with these young players and give them an opportunity. But when you look at, like, I get it, and I think it's in some ways an admirable approach to something like this. But when you look at the strength of the Chelsea side and just how successful they were and kind of what happened on the day, you can look now and think that was pretty inevitable.
Yeah, well, I look back at my blog post at the time and I said, I basically said that they did the club and the fans proud because it was such a young side. But really, like you say, Walcott scored the opening goal and then Drogba basically ground us down. And that's a story as old as time, sadly, is Chelsea strikers grinding us down. And I think that kind of youthful, attempt to win everything with youth or win with youth, it went on for ages. Had its upsides, but clearly we were a bit too easy to beat. But it's astonishing. You look back and how quickly that winning side from 2004 was dismantled. There was almost nobody left by this point.
Yeah, and it was a bit of a mad game as well, because it was the game in which Abu Diaby kicked John Terry into kingdom come, and he was saved by, was it Gary Loon or Colin Loon? I can't remember. One of the Arsenal physios was there on the side, and it looked like he'd swallowed his tongue and all that kind of stuff. So that was drama. And then, of course, Drogba was, he was he was just unplayable at times at this point in his career, where he was really, really a physical force. And I know poor old Philippe Senderos got a hard time because he found it hard to live with Drogba that day. I think there was one of the goals in particular. There was a header where it was just pure power from Drogba. But, that was true of a lot of central defenders in the Premier League and in Europe at that time, who found it very, very difficult to live with Drogba.
Yeah, definitely. We had a string of Arsenal defenders. He wasn't the only one who for years struggled with players like that. So, there's no denying he was a brilliant player, but it was frustrating that he, I think psychologically we were scared of players like him when, especially a young side like that.
Yeah.
So, there was a big scrap, two sendings off, one of which was Adebayor.
Yeah, he'd only come on as a sub or something as well.
Khaled Soure, John Obi Mikel. Like you say, you compare and contrast the two sides. It's chalk and cheese in terms of what they cost and their experience and the result, was a little bit inevitable.
Yeah, Eboué was banned afterwards for swinging a punch, I think, at Wayne Bridge, but he missed. if he was another player at another team, maybe he'd have got away with it, but not quite so. Right. So where are we going? Go on.
Interesting point about Walcott as well. It's his first goal. He was 17, and I don't know about you, but I've just got this really curious relationship with Walcott in terms of what I think about him, and I think a lot of Arsenal fans probably do as well, because that was the first of many goals for Walcott. He's ended up scoring 108 goals, very high up in the Arsenal scoring charts over time. It was one season, quite a few seasons later, when he was our top scorer, when he was playing as a striker. And by all measurements, he was an extremely successful player for Arsenal, a very good player. But I also have these memories of him, plenty of them, of him just infuriatingly offside. And, lots of things about him where he was never able to knock him out of his game.
Yeah.
Well, you look at the stats and the stats, speak for themselves, don't they?
Well, only 13 or 14 players in our entire history, the entire history of this club, have scored more goals for Arsenal than Theo Walcott. But I think you're right. I always found him an extremely frustrating player, because some of the things that he did were so he made them look so easy. I remember one goal in a European game. I can't remember who it was. We were playing in a yellow away kit. Might have been the same season that we Van Persie was sent off against Barcelona. But we broke from deep, and he was so quick, took the ball into their half, and it was one of those where he was going one-on-one with the goalkeeper, and you were expecting him to take it a little bit closer to the keeper before he finished. And he took the finish really, really early and just curled it around him. You know, that pass into the bottom corner of the net, the Thierry Henry finish. And you're looking at him and you're going, wow, you know, to be able to do that, the confidence to do that, the finishing ability to do that. And then he would have games where, like you say, he was offside, or he would run the ball out of play, or he would, you know, fall over his own feet, or, you know, just never see a touch of the ball. It was frustrating, because I think the frustration was based around a lot of what he did and the good things that he did, and just being unable really to do it as consistently as we would have hoped, because he did come at 16 years of age with the promise of something special, you know. And I suppose to be Arsenal's 15th highest goal scorer of all time is pretty special in the grand scheme of things. But, you know, I know where you're coming from with you know, what that perception of him as probably a bit clumsy, a little bit careless at times.
And just you know, almost like, you know, the things you know from the game, and you never quite got there. And so, So yeah, but this was his first goal, and it was a great goal too.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was a sort of interesting. But we also, League Cup wise, not been a good tournament. Not been a good trainer at all, not for Arsenal, actually, for ages.
Yeah.
So, you know, we it was one that always eluded us, and that one did too.
Yeah, painful, painful. All right, what's next?
Well, sort of going off the field now a bit, because it was quite a monumental year, consider what's happened since, for the ownership of the club.
Yeah.
Because April 2007, we've got Kroenke buying 9.9% stake from the club, of all people, ITV. Yeah. I'd completely forgotten that ITV owned some shares in Arsenal. I think it was something to do with the On Digital thing from a few years before. But I look back on this, you know, I was up a few things about this year, and I thought, I have no recollection of that at all. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, I mean, there was something to do with the broadband. You remember there used to be like an Arsenal internet, and could you get like an arsenal.net email address or something like that? I can't quite remember.
I just can't remember. No, I can't. But I mean, it was might be related to the ITV digital. I don't know, but certainly a sort of curious thing to happen. And then he bought that, and that was the start of very patient growth of shares in the club, which, you know, ultimately we, you know, obviously led to him owning it and buying out all the small shareholders, and now being 100% owner of Arsenal. So that all started 2007. It feels like a long game that he was playing, really.
Yeah, but I mean, it was followed quite quickly by his departure. When Stan Kroenke bought the ITV shares, David Dean was gone very, very quickly. If I remember, it was only a couple of weeks, something like that, and it was like really sudden, wasn't it? It was all of a sudden there was this irreconcilable differences situation going on where he was out the door. And, you know, I think there's a big story there that hasn't really been told in its entirety, to be honest, about how it all went down and what the plan was and all of that kind of stuff. But pretty much my understanding of it is that when Kroenke bought the shares, he was expecting to be welcomed as a shareholder. And whatever happened, the rest of the Arsenal board, the shareholders, the chairman, the Danny Fisman and the other big shareholders, felt like that situation was hostile. And David Dean was pretty quickly removed from his position at Arsenal. And when you look back on it now and where we are and who owns us and everything else, that was very much the start of it.
It was very much the start of it, wasn't it? And, you know, he sold his shares to Red and White Holdings. So as went off of Mashiri, and that's when, the battle began.
That's it. I mean, the Arsenal Cold War at board level at executive level that had some twists and turns, but ultimately ended up between Kroenke and Usmanov as this situation where Kroenke was never going to sell to Usmanov. Usmanov kept trying to buy things. Kroenke wouldn't sell. And we had this, in essence, a cold war between these two big shareholders that wasn't good for the club. I don't think anyone can look back on that and say that was in any way a healthy situation for Arsenal to be in and to be run, because, you know, Kroenke, as the majority shareholder, couldn't be, you know, there was nobody could do anything. Even if Usmanov wanted to do something, he couldn't do it. It was only ever really going to end one way. And we had just had years and years and years and years of this boardroom battle, and I don't know, it wasn't great.
No, and you know, there's a whole train of thought, you know, away from the actual kind of nuts bolts of selling and buying the shares, but there's obviously a train of thought. He left Wenger. I think he admitted later, didn't he, that he very nearly left too, and they were really close. And Dean was a great football man, and able to make some great football decisions. And there's an argument that we never really properly replaced him. That was an argument that rumbled on even to now.
How do you view that now? How do you view that now? Yeah. Then, knowing that it was David Dean who brought Stan Kroenke to Arsenal. It was David Dean who brought Alisher Usmanov to Arsenal. Obviously, with some ambition, I guess, that with these new owners, he would remain as part of, you know, the board, or maybe perhaps somebody who was going to have a very strong hand in running the club. He got well paid for his shares by Alisher Usmanov. And I guess ultimately it didn't really work to the benefit of Arsenal for many years. And you know, I'm not doubting his fanhood or anything like that, but I always find it quite curious when people say, well, we never replaced David Dean. We never, you know, were able to rekindle that magic at executive level, which he had, which I think is true. And clearly his relationship with Wenger and everything else was really positive for the club, but it's sort of, abdicates him of his own responsibility for how it all went down, in a way.
Yeah, of course. And I think there will always be two sides to the story. You know, he was there, I think, from 1983. So he was there when George Graham came to the club and Wenger, and presided as vice chairman over, you know, the most successful period, you could argue, bar the 1930s of the club. So certainly in modern times. And so, you know, he was instrumental in that. But like you say, the flip side of it is that he ended up selling his shares, and the boardroom struggle that went on after that cannot have did not help Arsenal in terms of its focus on what it needed to do, which was, you know, build a team that could win the title. So I guess that's the rub of the green, isn't it? You get two sides to the story.
I mean, it was well over a year before we actually made an official appointment to replace David Dean at executive level. Like, there were people there, of course. It was Ken Fryer there, Danny Fisman was there, you know, a lot of those board members were there. But as somebody who was going to do a lot of the stuff that David Dean did, and what I guess Ivan Gazidis became, but it was like late 2008, early 2009 before Gazidis came along. And I think the other consequence of it, in a way, was just how much power it gave Arsene Wenger over pretty much all the football matters at the club. Because I think Dean was like a sounding board, in a way, wasn't he? They were, to all intents and purposes, a double act, where even if Wenger was vacillating over something, which, you know, we came to understand was part of his nature, Dean might say, well, let's get this done. Whereas without him, and with Gazidis ultimately somebody who Wenger had played a part in appointing, that dynamic completely changed, didn't it? So the consequences of that departure weren't just at executive level, but all the power that it gave Arsene.
Yeah, the power it gave Arsene, and the fact that having even more to do than he already had to do, put unimaginable amount of pressure on him, and that can't have been helpful either.
No.
To be honest.
All right.
Yeah, that was the beginning of that.
Yeah, and what a that it was. What's next?
Well, I don't know. I was going to talk a bit about Fabregas. Now, I suspect you're going to have about 5 years running on this where you get somebody talking a bit about Fabregas. Because he was, for all of the departures of the Invincibles, he was what an absolute, I suppose you could say, one of the world-class players that we had in the post-Invincibles era. And maybe we didn't have enough of those players like him. And, you know, he inherited Vieira's number four shirt. He played every single league game 2006-07. He won the player of the season that year, 2007, and again, 2008. And I just got a little quote I wrote after we beat United at home in late 2007. And I said, but for me, well, Fabregas, whose overall game was just such a joy to watch. He never panics. He finds space when you wouldn't think it was there. He can pass short. He can pass long. And if he's worth anything less than 30 million already, then I'm a Dutchman. Now, 30 million doesn't seem like very much now, but it was then. And, I think that kind of sums it up. He really was there, even at 19, and he'd been playing for a couple of seasons by this point. Even at 19, he was an absolutely phenomenal player. And he was able to elevate Arsenal in that midfield when, many of his teammates at the time weren't able to do it. So, we really were beginning the sort of era of Fabregas at this point, and it was an absolute pleasure to have him. And I look back with such fondness on his time at Arsenal. He was a phenomenal player.
Yeah, unbelievable. And clearly the main building block of that youth project and what Arsene Wenger was trying to do. And I'm sure when he thinks back in his career, Arsene Wenger has plenty of regrets about things he did and didn't do. But I can't help but think that if he could change maybe just one thing beyond something like the Champions League final in 2006, if he could change one thing, it'd be getting Fabregas the midfield partner that he absolutely deserved, because he was such a, as you say, phenomenal player, an incredible talent, unbelievable maturity at such an early age. That point about finding space where you don't think it was there. Not only did he find space where you didn't think it was there, while he was finding space, he was looking up to see who was moving, where the pass was, and how quickly he could move the ball there. That's, my abiding memory of him is him just scanning as the ball comes to him before he moves it off. And I do think that is something that Wenger made a mistake with, that he asked Fabregas to carry midfield partners who weren't up to the task, who weren't ready even. Someone like Alex Song, who, in time developed into an okay player, but for a long time, wasn't. Danielson, who started out quite well but faded. Diaby, who was pretty much, ruined by that injury. As much as he tried and as hard as he tried, he just never had the partnerships there. I can't remember exactly what year it was, but I do remember writing a blog post saying, God, I wish we would sign Mikel Arteta from Everton, because I think he would be such a great addition to the midfield to play with Fabregas, not as a replacement for him, as he kind of turned out to be in a way.
He fitted that mould for Arteta, because this is another curious thing that I've, if I was ever able to ask Wenger one question, it would be why did you go from having really powerful, as in physically powerful, centre midfield, which you did, and then you pivoted to technically great players, but quite small players mostly. I mean, I know Diaby was quite tall, but they were, and I think there's another thing that you kind of think: well, could we or would we have benefited from having more power as well as the panache and the skill in that middle to really? Because I think people lost the fear factor of Arsenal, and some of that was down to we were quite a small side physically, and he never, that kind of size element never The sort of Vieira replacement thing, I know it's a cliche, but it never really happened, did it?
No. And it sort of came at a time when the Arsenal don't like it up and thing was in full swing, and we saw injuries to players, and we saw the team get bullied because they were young and they were maybe a bit small. And I know when I did that podcast over the lockdown or the pandemic with Cesc, we spoke about the Xabi Alonso thing and how, what a game changer that might have been, you know, not just for him, but for Arsenal to have a player of that caliber in the middle of the field with him. But yeah, his emergence was amazing to watch, really, wasn't it? When you consider his age and just how good he was from basically the first moment he got into the team. I don't mean the League Cup, but when he started in that Charity Shield game that year against United and was just so good, you could see, well, look, there's only one place this is going.
You don't start aged, what was it, 15 years and something, or certainly 16 when yeah. he made his debut. You don't start at that age if you haven't got something special. You don't find players that come along like that very frequently, to be honest.
Yeah.
And the other thing about him, he wasn't just technically brilliant. He had an edge to him. He really wanted to win.
Mm.
And, you know, and I think we lacked a bit of that as well. I think we lacked a bit of guile, at times. But he was, he had a bit of that as well. So he really was the kind of all-round package.
Yeah.
I look back very fondly at his time at Arsenal, you know, that goal he scored straight after the kickoff against Spurs was so quick that the cameraman was nowhere to be seen, and that kind of summed him up. He was always on, you know, he was always spotting that opportunity and always, you know, never ever resting on his laurels. So you know, for all of the downsides of these few years at Arsenal, when we were sort of very much nearly men, he was definitely a very good memory.
Yeah, I know a lot of people have their own opinions about, you know, how he left and where he ended up after Barcelona and all that kind of stuff, which I completely understand, but just absolutely one of my favorite Arsenal players ever. And you know, I wish we could have kept him longer, and I wish we could have built a better team around him, but we didn't, and there you go. So where are we going next?
Well, you can't mention 2007 without mentioning Thierry Henry's departure.
Mm.
So, you know, we're talking about good goal scorers in Theo Walcott. Well, we had the absolute ultimate best one who left in 2007 and 228 goals later. And, you know, actually, I look back at what I wrote about it when he left, and I realised it wasn't quite so smooth as I recalled it. So I said, you know, some people will chide him for courting Barcelona and for being too vocal about Dean's departure. Others for his uncaptain-like strops. And more still may take him to task on his occasional selfish play. Me, I just like to remember the positives. So there's me, maybe not quite remembering all the positives, but actually, you know, those last few months, or maybe even year or so, I remember we were all desperate for him to stay, but kind of wondering whether it was also the right time for him to go. But that was the year he finally did. And, again, almost impossible to replace a player like him. Certainly, with the regularity, goal scoring regularity that he gave Arsenal. And again, talking of power and pace and everything, he had the lot. What a sensational player he was.
Yeah. My recollection of it, and again, this is 15 years ago, so my mind could be playing tricks with me. I know that last season was quite difficult, and there were some injury problems as well, weren't there? There was like an ongoing back problem, sciatica or something like that. And there were stories about, you know, maybe some issues with Arsene Wenger or some behavioural problems. I can't quite remember. But I sort of, when I think about it, it sort of just happened. But it was ongoing. There was all sorts of stories in the press, and you know, the Spanish press, we've been well acquainted with them down the years, was full of stories about, well, the move is imminent, it's just a matter of time, all those kind of buzzwords about how it happened. And then it was, what, towards the end of June, when he left, mid to late June. And he talked about David Dean, didn't he? He said David Dean is no longer there, and this has destabilized the team and the manager, and he made some comment about Arsene Wenger's contract and put some doubt over that and all of that kind of stuff. So Yeah, he might have gone the year before, of course. When we played Barcelona in the Champions League final, and maybe he stayed a year when he didn't necessarily want to stay a year.
Yeah, and it was another saga, a bit like Vieira's. Will he go? Will he stay? In the end, he did, and actually, obviously, he had a heroic comeback some years later. So, that was quite a nice bookend to his Arsenal career. But that was the year he went. And actually, I was thinking more widely about, we mentioned it a little earlier about the Invincible side, and maybe I just need to let it go. But, that year Henry left, Lauren left, Campbell left, Ljungberg, Reyes, Aliadier. I don't think there were many left by that point. And it's not that long after, maybe that team was always on the down, once it did that.
Mm.
But, it was a very quick dismantling. Onto new times and away from the old. But it was quite a big year for that.
It was emotional, wasn't it? Because he'd been so talismanic is the wrong word. He was just such a big part of everything that had been good about us for the previous years. And like, I'm sure you remember at the time when we sold Nicolas Anelka and we signed Thierry Henry from Juventus. And at the time he was, wasn't really playing as a striker. He was playing as a winger, a wing back at times. He wasn't scoring goals. And I think there was trust in Arsene Wenger at that time. But also, I'm not sure too many people were convinced, including Henry himself, that he was going to come in and become what he became at Arsenal, the player he became. And clearly the conditions and the coaching and the players he had around him and the team he was in and the environment that he was in were just the Goldilocks porridge, whatever you want to call it. Everything was just right for him to become absolutely the best player that he could ever hope to have become, to see a player do that, to arrive at Arsenal when people are going, is this guy going to score any goals? There's no way he's going to be as good as Nicolas Anelka. I mean, you look back now, and Wenger has said it more than once, like the plan was for Henry and Anelka. That's what he has always said. Imagine. Fucking hell.
I know. And actually, we were still in the era when he signed for Arsenal, when Wenger was really steps ahead of most other managers in terms of knowing what the market, like especially the French market, not just. Knowing who was out there with Vieira and Henry, he found two cheap-ish gems. And I think most of the other clubs ended up catching up, expanding their scouting networks, doing whatever they did, but they caught up. But at that time, he was, he really had an eye for it. And Henry was, the epitome of his ability to spot a player who is that classic mix. It's a bit like what Arteta's trying to do now, in that what he wants is players who are hungry, but have something to prove.
Mm.
And I think Henry was very much in that mold, same as Vieira. They had gone to a big club and it hadn't worked. They were young and they had something to prove, and persuaded them to come to Arsenal. And, boy, did they prove us all, prove Wenger right. So, he really was had that incredible touch at the time, Wenger, which, kind of deserted him after a while. Just because I think other teams caught up and there was, other teams, these things happen, but Henry was one, was an absolute gem.
16 million still feels a bit cheap, doesn't it?
It really does. Yeah, it does. Although at the time, I think it was a lot of money.
But, I remember thinking at the time, okay, look, I know he's heading towards the September of his career, but still, 16 million, he was 30 years of age, though, I suppose. He was 29 or 30.
And I don't know, it's probably a contractual 30. Thing by that point, wasn't it? How much longer did he have left on his contract? I can't even remember.
No, he'd signed a new contract after the Champions League final, because that was, I think, a thing that annoyed some people, was that he signed a new contract and got a very big signing on fee, a loyalty bonus, if you like, and then left the following year. So I don't quite know.
Are you
know.
Telling me that somebody getting a big contract in the autumn of their career isn't always a good idea?
It's a remarkable thing to consider, I know. But there you go. We should mention, I suppose, the player who we brought in to replace him, and it was a very Arsene Wenger-like signing. And one of the last signings, I think, in the internet era when nobody had a clue. Not a single person had a clue that Eduardo da Silva was gonna come into the club. Maybe that is just worth mentioning for that alone. Simply the out of the blue factor of that is not something that you can replicate these days.
No, God no. It's almost forensic what you know about who's going where or who fancies who and all that kind of stuff. It's amazing. But yeah, he was another player who would have been, woulda, coulda, shoulda and all that. But obviously it's not 2007, but it's not long after. I think it's early 2008 when his leg snapped against and Gallas has his meltdown. And, it's a very easy, it's not always easy to mention, to see moments that change time, but that was one of them for him, especially.
Yeah.
But for Arsenal too.
Yeah. A Brazilian who'd become Croatian international. We signed him from Dinamo Zagreb, and I think it was just really beginning to grow into the team and to get used to English football, and then the injury happened. But a big shame. Okay, we've got one more thing. So what are we going to talk about?
Well, before we move on, I just wanted to say something that I wrote, which was when Lauren left in 2007, I think I said, now Wenger can concentrate on moulding Eboué and Hoyt. So, hindsight is a wonderful thing, and I don't think it worked out.
Yeah, no, it's fair to say that didn't quite go as well as we might have liked when Lauren
not
left.
As well as
but, I think, was it that summer? It was that summer of 2007 when we signed Bakary Sagna from Auxerre. So, Hoyt and Eboué were yesterday's men at that point, because Sagna came in and was a really fantastic signing, one of the most consistent players of that period in our history, that sort of difficult 2007 to 2014 kind of period where the trophy drought became a big thing and the team was a lot more inconsistent and everything else. But he was certainly one of the more consistent players.
Yeah, he was. He was a fabulous player. Really, really made the places, made the slot his own, and some good memories of him against Spurs too.
Sure. I mean, I do remember people say, but do we need a right back? Do we even need a right back? Mm. And yes, we did. Yes.
We did. So the last thing which I've got to talk about this year, and is actually, despite me criticising various elements of our recruitment strategy for the the last 36 minutes, we were actually top at Christmas.
Wow.
Top at Christmas in 2007, and I believe that was the last time that we were
ever. Surely not.
Well, since then. I think so. But again, my Googling might have failed me there. But certainly in December that year, we won 14 from 21 points. We smashed Everton away 4-1. 47 points from 20. So, of course, inevitably, Wenger got asked at Christmas time, could we go unbeaten again? Because obviously that's what people ask Wenger. And he said, people will talk, just let us play. And then we lost at Borough.
Right. As you do.
In the new year. So I think it was 18 games unbeaten. That's pretty good in the run-up to Christmas.
Mm. 47 points, top of the table. Manchester United second on 45. Chelsea third on 41 points. And at the end of the season, where were we? Where did we finish that year? Third with 80 points. Wow.
Yeah.
That was a year when... Yeah, that season, and we'll obviously talk about this a bit more in the 2008 episode, but where a title was certainly possible. And you wonder, it was a bit of a sliding doors moment, that one, wasn't it? Because what it might have given that group of players, because it wasn't until quite late in the season, I remember a game against Man United, maybe Owen Hargreaves scoring a free kick, which pretty much put pay to our chances of continuing to fight for the title.
Yeah. And like you say, I think, as you say, it's one for 2008, but that it's very rare you can pinpoint a single game where your fortunes fundamentally changed. And that Birmingham away one was that game. I don't think, you know, they were ever quite the same after that. So, so that young team did, you know, it wasn't like it was without, without its strengths. It really was, but it just never had quite enough to, you know, when spring turned and the pressure hit hard and stuff, it just wasn't quite there.
Yeah. What might have been, eh? What might have been?
What might have been? Yeah. And you look at us now and, you know, we toiled away and at the time we thought, you know, fourth is no trophy and it was all a big thing. But now, Christ, you'd take fourth, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would take fourth. And I take some hair on my head again, as I had back in 2007.
I'd take the capacity to remember anything that happened in a year.
Sure.
15 years ago. That'd be nice.
Wouldn't that be fun? Anyway, at least we have a documentation of our years as Arsenal bloggers and everything else. But look, we will leave it there, Jim. Thank you very much for taking the trip down memory lane with us, 2007. Really appreciate it. And keep up the fine, if very occasional, blogging these days.
It's very infrequent, but I will do my best. And it's been fun chatting about stuff. 2007.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. You can follow Jim on Twitter. He is at East Lower, and very occasionally he picks up the blogging quill and parchment and sticks down some thoughts at eastlower.co.uk. That's eastlower.co.uk. Hope you enjoyed that episode. Plenty more to come, of course, in this series. But for now, we will leave it there. So until the next one, take it easy. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.